So welcome to the F Word. It's the first in a series of events that the Wheeler Centre is putting on, and we're lucky to have Roxane Gay with us this evening.
Yeah! Don't you people have anything better to do? This is ridiculous.
Roxane is the author of An Untamed State, which was published last year, and also Bad Feminist, a collection of essays, thoughts, bits of memoir, an incredible book, as those of you who've read it will know. She has written in many forms, blogging, different news publications. Time magazine named 2014 the year of Roxane Gay, although... We've just been talking and I've told her that there needs to be a new queen and 2015 is my year, so... The Guardian has called Bad Feminist the most persuasive feminist recruitment drive in recent memory. We're going to have a lot of fun talking about Bad Feminist and Untamed State and hopefully answering some questions that all of you have. Welcome to Australia and welcome to Melbourne.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Great haircuts, everyone. I am feeling your haircuts and other hairstyles. I saw some great dreads, but it just has a lot going on, so stay tuned.
So I thought what I would do is essentially just ask Roxane all the things I want to know and forget that all you guys are here. So I thought a great starting point would be how Bad Feminist came about. You talk in the opening chapter of the book about this kind of reluctance in your mid-20s to identify with feminism for various reasons, including, you know, issues of intersectionality and race and all of those kinds of things. And I guess I'm wanting to know about the journey from that reluctance to identify with feminism to an embracing of it in Bad Feminist.
Accident. It was entirely an accident. I wrote an essay a couple of years ago called Bad Feminist because I wanted to think through my journey to feminism and acknowledge that for a long time I didn't want to claim feminism because all too often it's the F word and you're branded as someone who wants too much by, you know, heretically thinking that women are equal to men. Oh my God. And so I wrote this essay and it really allowed me to just, it felt like confession. Say, oh God, I'm such a mess. But I'm still a feminist. And it felt really good to do that. And so at first it was tongue in cheek, but the more I thought about it and the more the essay went out into the world and I started hearing from people and the more I wrote other essays sort of informed by that worldview, the more I realized I was onto something. And I started to collect my thoughts and my essays. And when it came time to title the collection, I was just like, oh yeah. Bad Feminist. It was originally called What We Hunger For, but I was told that that was too many words. So, I guess Bad Feminist it is.
And in that opening section of the book, you also talk a lot about kind of when dissecting feminism and why you had this initial reluctance. You talk about a lot about the notion of privilege and I guess the kind of weight that that word has these days. Something that you also pick up in Untamed State. For those of you who haven't read it, Untamed State is an incredible book. It's about a black American woman of Haitian descent, Muriel Duval, who goes back to Haiti and, I guess I'll let you tell the rest. But yeah, there's kind of that issue of privilege, for me, it seemed to run through a lot of your work.
Yeah, I do think about privilege a lot because I've been very lucky in my life. And I grew up with loving parents and I grew up middle class and then upper middle class. I've always had access to education, healthcare, food, water. And the older I've gotten, the more I've appreciated that this is not the way life is for everyone. And so my parents are from Port-au-Prince, Haiti. And growing up, they used to take us to Port-au-Prince during the summers. And it was amazing. It was like an adventure every time. We went to the beach and the mountains. And my dad would climb coconut trees. And he's a weirdo. Like, he's super strict. And, like, he's a businessman. He is, like, you know, Roxane. And so it's just all work and no play. And so in Haiti, he was this entirely different person. And I realize now it's that he was home. And so the older I got, the more I realized that there was another side to paradise and that there were people who were making the luxury of my lifestyle in Haiti possible. And that was hard for me to reconcile. Like, how do you go to the beach and frolic at Club Med when there is a shanty town built right up next to your grandmother's house? You know, these are questions that I grappled with and that I still grapple with. So I wrote a novel called An Untamed State about a Haitian-American woman who returns to Port-au-Prince, and she's visiting her family with her American husband and her infant son, and she's kidnapped and held for 13 days because her father is reluctant to pay the ransom. He worries that if he pays the ransom to one kidnapper, they're going to come for his entire fortune that he's built in the United States and returned home with. And so it's a novel that looks at the effects of privilege in a lot of different ways. I was really interested in the question, what happens to someone when they have to endure that kind of betrayal? But I was also interested in what happens in your life that makes you think you can steal someone else from their life? And what drives you to that level of desperation and cruelty? And I think that absolute poverty will make you do just about anything. And so I was very interested in that.
You talk in Bad Feminist as well about this notion of writing the other. There's a chapter which focuses on things like Django Unchained and The Help and these characters that are not necessarily written by black writers. And I guess the kind of implicit kind of weight of writing, not from your own background. And in Untamed State, you do this very successfully. The first-person accounts of Muriel are kind of contrasted against these kind of more at a distance accounts from her American husband. And I guess I wanted to know how you navigated that, because I feel it has been a success. In Bad Feminist, you kind of use The Help as an example of how not how not to write somebody else's story.
The Help is a fucking mess. it just is. And so whenever I'm writing Difference, I just think, not The Help. And so that's also something you can have, too. You know, when I write Difference, first of all, I think that we make such a big deal out of how do you write the other, and we treat people who are different as if they are unknowable and alien, and I think that's offensive. That a person of color, for example, is so confusing and unknowable to a white person that they can't manage to write it. Meanwhile, hobbits. that's just weird. Tolkien wrote an entire language, Elvish, and we're confused by the black experience. That's just not great. And so I start from a place of commonality that we all have desires and we all have needs. And then I start to think about if I had a different body or a different skin color or a different gender, how would I move through the world? And how would this event that I'm writing about affect me? And so I try to write from a place of empathy and understanding. And I think if more writers did that, we would be fine. I think anyone can write about anything. It's just intent. And when you look at something like The Help, I do think that Catherine Stockett was really just feeling nostalgic for her black maid. And bless her heart, I get it. But she didn't think it through. And it's just not good. And so there's a line where Abilene, who's one of the maids in The Help, she refers to her skin, she refers to herself as black like a cockroach. Now, I have been like, right? Who just made that serious sigh? Was that you? Yes, leopard print. I mean, it's just amazing. She, you know, it's just, and I've never let go of that. And I talk about it almost every week because I'm still obsessed with how fucked up it is. Because there are a lot of ways to refer to black skin: jet black, ebony, obsidian, cocoa. Like, and then most of them are cheesy, like caramel, red bone, you know. But I don't know a single black person that's like, I think I'm feeling cockroachy today.
I do it all the time.
Do you? I stand corrected. I stand corrected. And so it's frustrating because it's not even big things that they're getting wrong. It's just the simplest shit that they get wrong. And that's offensive. It's just, it's not even offensive. Oh, see, I'm going to just get, but to write an essay, give me a pen. It's just very frustrating to see. I mean, it's so much easier to do better. Just give a damn about people in the world and think about, like, how would someone you love who is black feel to know that you think that's how we might describe ourselves? And I have also never seen black skin that looks anything like cockroach. So maybe she, I don't know. I just don't know where that came from. And then there's also a line where one of the maids is like, yeah, when I'm feeling sad, I just cook some fried chicken. And I understand what she was going for, where, you know, that she was finding solace in cooking, like, food. Like, cooking is awesome. But she didn't really think through some of the cultural implications of that line. Like, there are just some things you can't say. And so, you know, it's really hard to write difference, but it's really easy to write difference. And I wish more people would focus on how easy it is and just focus on humanity.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the really incredible things about Bad Feminist is that it takes a lot of what we know, you know, the Hunger Games, the Help, Django Unchained, Girls, and kind of unpacks a lot of these things that are going on. I mean, they are just kind of examples of their various genres. There's so much of that stuff going on. I'm interested to know, I guess, what if any feedback you've had from, because I mean, you are very vocal about the things that you're passionate about and like the Hunger Games and the way that they treat their protagonist, and there's other things like Girls where you're not so kind of complimentary. Has there been much feedback?
Oh, yeah. Has there been feedback? It's funny. I told my parents not to read my books, and I didn't even tell them about the books until my dumbass brother told the entire family during the release week of my novel, and then Time Magazine wrote this article, and my dad called and he was like, I saw you on Time. And so I said, okay, fine. And so they read the novel, and then I said, don't read Bad Feminist, just because I'm 40 and there are some conversations I don't want to have. And my mom has respected my wishes, and my father has not. He has read Bad Feminist from cover to cover, and he called me up and he said, well, you know, Roxanne, I hope you have it. Thick skin, you criticize a lot. And that's actually exactly how he sounds. So I've gotten a lot of feedback. I've actually talked to Lena Dunham about my essay about Girls, and we had a really productive conversation. And she totally understood where I was coming from, and it was great to see that she was able to see that I wasn't trying to beat up on her and that I also recognized the merits of what she did. Another person I actually got direct feedback from was Lean In, Sheryl Sandberg. Mm-hmm. I got an email from her and I thought it was a joke. And she invited me to lunch at Facebook and I was like, ooh, really? Is this real or is someone fucking with me? And turns out it was totally real. And so I went to Facebook and had lunch with her. And she was like, I read your essay. And I was like, oh shit, I'm on Facebook. What am I gonna do? I'm like, I hope someone knows where I am. But she was really gracious. And she was like, well, I disagreed with some of what you had to say. I was like, I would expect that. So I do get some feedback, but a lot of the feedback I get is just from people who are very attached to some of the pop culture that I address and want me to, like, they want to avenge their pop culture. I wrote an essay for Salon about Daniel Tosh, who's a comedian. Oh. Oh, leopard print, we're going to be good friends. And so he's this comedian, and he's just not my cup of tea, probably because I'm old. but also because he has no sense of boundaries and is inappropriate and not funny. Don't put this video on the web. No, I'm just kidding. You know, he's just not my cup of tea, but he had made a rape joke because he was heckled during a performance, and he said, wouldn't it be funny if that girl got gang raped on the way out? I'm like, dude, no. That's actually the opposite of funny. And so I wrote an essay about this, and in the comments, which I no longer read much, a man said, angry blogger woman, which I went by. I was like, you can call me that in bed now. angry blogger woman, if you make the Comedy Central cancel Tosh 2.0, I just don't even know what I'm gonna do. And I was just like, who do you think I am? Comedy Central doesn't give a single solitary fuck about me or what I have to say about Daniel Tosh. And his show is doing fine. So sometimes I get feedback like that where people feel like having an opinion about something means that somehow it's instantly gonna get off the air. Like, who has that kind of power? Though I do feel like my essay about blurred lines might have led to the lawsuit. Did you know he made $5.6 million off that song? Wow. Everybody get up. I mean, but he's going to have to pay a lot of that to the estate of Marvin Gaye. Yes. Don't fuck with gay.
What I really like about your work is you don't shy away from the uncomfortable, and that's true with both your nonfiction and your fiction. Untamed State is one of the most visceral books I've ever read, and it's an incredible book, and it deals with that, you know, the issue of sexual assault, obviously, mm-hmm. in a kidnap situation. What was the process of writing that like? I imagine you probably have to keep a fair distance from the material sometimes.
You know, for that book, well, when I write fiction, I do like total immersion. I'm like a method writer. I totally pretend like I'm the protagonist, which is not something I recommend per se. Because then sometimes people are like trying to ask me a question and like, don't you see I'm in Paris right now? It's very frustrating that they don't understand. But I really just try to like imagine being the character. And so I wrote the novel in the summer of 2010. And I just wrote every day. I wrote it like a fever dream. And that's the way this book needed to be written, because what she went through was relentless. And so I wrote it that way as well. And one of the things I was most committed to when I was writing the novel was the violence. And I wanted to make sure that the violence was uncomfortable. I didn't want it to be stylized the way it is often stylized in television and movies and books. I wanted it to be repulsive. And so I wrote the violence in a way that was explicit and unflinching. I hate that word in reviews, but nonetheless, I didn't flinch. And so I felt like that was the right way to honor Mireille's story. And to honor the experience of what she endures, which is essentially torture at the hands of several men over this course of 2 weeks. And I wanted the reader to look away. I wanted you to be so repulsed that you couldn't read through, because I think if you read through, we're not doing our job as writers. We're making it seem like this is something endurable. And for her, it wasn't. And so that's what I went with, and I struggled with it because I didn't want it to be gratuitous, but I kept thinking of this movie I saw called Irreversible, which is still to this day one of the few movies I have not watched more than once and will never watch again. There's a very brutal rape scene in the movie that I've never seen anything like. It's literally unwatchable, and I think that's how you do it. I didn't go that far. The Gaspar Noé is special. But that really inspired me quite a lot in terms of just facing the violence head on, and also trying to give a reader the sense of what it was like to be in a body violated in that manner.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that you also talk about in Bad Feminist, that kind of how you use a woman's body to tell a story. Mm-hmm. And there are several examples you give of things like 12 Years as a Slave, where women's bodies are used to further the story of a male protagonist. And I kind of really saw, I guess, that marriage between the kind of narratives you were talking about with Django Unchained, mm-hmm. and 12 Years as a Slave, where the violence or the language is quite gratuitous and it's not used, I guess, taking a feminist perspective, to further the story of any of the females. It's just kind of this gratuitous violence on the
side. It's crazy. And we see this in a lot of entertainment. Rape is a storyline. Rape is a way to get ratings during sweeps season. And with Django Unchained and 12 Years a Slave, and now 12 Years a Slave, to be fair, is based on a true story. And so Patsy was a real woman who did suffer. But in the movie, her suffering was the centerpiece. And it was her suffering that made Solomon's slavery worse. And I'm like, no, it made her slavery worse. And so I struggled with how it was her constant torture and violation and degradation that was really used to show us how hard it was for Solomon. And no, I wanted to see more how hard it was for Patsy. And then in Django Unchained, we have Django on this quest to find his woman who's been kidnapped. And like the whole quest is to get to her, and she's tormented and nothing good happens to her either. And again, it's used so that the man can have his hero narrative. And we see that all too often, that women and women's bodies are used as narrative devices to help men become more fully realized. And I think that's nonsense.
In Bad Feminist, I guess I was interested in the structure of the book. Mm-hmm. At the beginning, we get a real sense of who you are, you kind of navigating that world of early professorship, going into teaching in schools, and the kind of, I guess, battles that you have with the students, butting heads against them on occasion. Was there a lot of kind of editorial input? I mean, I found it kind of really great to navigate, because by the time we got into the essays, we knew who you were, we knew what your background was.
Yes, of course. There's always editorial input, and I've been really lucky. My editor for Bad Feminist is a woman named Maya Zeev, and she's actually editing my next book, Hunger. The model for Bad Feminist, in terms of how I structured it, was the most unexpected model. It was Katie Royfe's In Praise of Messy Lives. And I disagree with nearly everything Katie Royfe writes or thinks or believes. But even though I find her opinions generally abhorrent, she can write really well. And she structured that essay collection in a really nice way, in sections. And it felt like she was presenting a story as a whole through these sections. And that's what I wanted to do. And so I start the essay collection out with some essays about myself, just giving you a sense of who I am and where I'm coming from, because I think that helps you see my worldview. And then I start to take on various aspects of our culture, through whether it's books or movies or music. And then we come back to me toward the end of the essay collection, because I'm a Libra and I like balance.
And you talk a lot as well in that first section about intersectionality, mm-hmm. and this issue, and also in the last section where you talk about Audre Lorde, this issue of being a woman of colour and being a feminist, and how traditionally, you know, they haven't been thought to have gone together. Mm-hmm. I remember an auntie of mine saying to me when I was very young, while the white feminists were out marching the streets, my mother was at home looking after their children. And I mean, that wasn't true. It was complete fiction. That was the way that she saw the movement. You know, mm-hmm. that was her reason for not getting involved. And so I was really interested to see that kind of, I guess, the slaying of that myth in a way, in that opening and in the closing of your book, to kind of say, look, this is everybody's fight.
It is. I understand why some women of color simply want nothing to do with feminism. And I also respect the women of color who identify as womanists. Feminism has betrayed working class women, women of color, queer women, transgender women, time and time again. But I really do believe that we will make more progress if we work together. And I think that we can come from different places and have different ideas about feminism and still accomplish good. And so for me, I'm more interested in how can we help more feminists understand and embody intersectionality rather than like sort of going off and creating my own movement. It just feels more useful to me that way. And I have gotten a lot of valuable experience from being a feminist. And it works. You know, I don't think feminism is perfect. Feminism frustrates me on a daily basis. But people frustrate me on a daily basis. So I don't lay that at the feet of feminism. I think all too often we want to blame feminism for everything that goes wrong. And that's so deeply unfair. And it's unrealistic. So I just was trying to do something a little different.
Mm-hmm. And I guess one question I wanted to ask was, how bad does a feminist have to be before they're not a feminist anymore?
Well, it all depends on what time she shows up at my hotel room. How bad does a feminist have to be? Sorry. Oh, I'm going to get in so much trouble. You know, okay, there is a line for me, and I struggle with this quite a lot, but I really think that if a woman is not pro-choice, like, I feel like maybe you can't be on our island. I get it, but I really get it, because I was raised Catholic, and I understand why people are pro-life. I actually do understand. I mean, I think there are people who are pro-life who are good, and then there are the crazy people that torture women who are trying to just handle their lives. And then, of course, there are legislators who are their own virulent plague. But I feel like, how can you really think that women are equal to men and then believe that we don't have the right to full autonomy over our bodies? And as much as I try to be all-encompassing and all-accepting, like, that's the one thing I can't quite convince myself of. I'm still working on it, but I'm really good with where I'm at right now. I feel like that's beyond bad. That's just disrespectful. It's like, you know, no one's saying you should go out and get an abortion. That's weird that you would think that. But it's let other women make decisions about their reproductive freedom and have unfettered access to birth control. And support women in terms of childcare, healthcare. I mean, there's just so much we could be doing. If you're not on board with that, then no, you don't get to play with us.
In the last section of the book, you also talk about social media and it kind of filling different spaces that journalism doesn't necessarily fill. And you're obviously an avid user of social media.
You really read my book. I'm so impressed. All right.
And it's, you know, it's used so much now as a tool for activism and for, you know, you talk about certain things like Sandy Hook Massacre and things like that, first knowing about those because of Twitter. Mm-hmm. So I wondered if you'd talk a bit about your relationship with social media and how that feeds into your work.
Well, here's social media, and here's my work, and here's me. I love social media because, believe it or not, I'm really shy and quiet, and so I am not good at interacting with other humans, making friends, any of that nonsense. And on social media, it's like, have cape will fly. Anything is possible. I just feel like I'm a totally different person. I'm like Clark Kent taking off the glasses. Look. And so I just feel safer being social on social media. And that's probably because I've been online so for an embarrassingly long time, since like 1990, and doing the same nerdy shit online since 1990. And so social media just allows me to connect, but also be alone. I don't like to be around other people all that much, and I don't want to make small talk. But on Twitter, it's fine because I can like switch to something else while we're talking about yogurt. And I love that. But I also think that Twitter is more powerful than just allowing us to share the mundane details of our lives, which I've come to enjoy. I like knowing what you ate for dinner. And I want to see a picture as well. And I love, 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 love when people talk about their kids and you can just tell they're like this close to murdering them. I'm just like, yes, bring more of that. But don't hurt the baby. But I think that it's also a great way for me. I can attribute so much of my recent success to social media and people following me on Twitter and then talking about my books, and then going out and buying them, and then reading them, and then tweeting at me about them. And that's awesome. And to be able to connect with readers in that way, I think is a game changer if you're willing to do it. And then there's activism. And I don't know in the US how much activism is really accomplished, but it seems like enough. It seems like it empowers people who are traditionally marginalized and who are traditionally not afforded platforms. And I think that's crucial. And when you look worldwide at what social media has enabled, it really can be a tool for major social change. And so I think that I love the spectrum of what it offers. And it definitely informs my work because I find that I'm better informed about a lot of things. And I also encounter opposing viewpoints in interesting ways. And I think that's good. Nobody should be in a thought vacuum where you are isolated and only hearing people who agree with you. That's not healthy or normal. And I never want to sort of be constantly surrounded by people who pretend to agree with me. That's not cool. Disagree with me, I'm going to be mad at you, but eventually I'll get over that and then we'll speak again. I just like the range of viewpoints that it affords me, and like I get shown writing that I would not normally read, and I learn about issues that I wouldn't normally know about. Like one of the essays in Bad Feminist, I write about a woman named Jessica Luther from Austin, Texas, who kept tweeting for weeks about some bill in Texas about abortion. And after a while, if you see someone tweeting about the same thing over and over, you start to pay attention. And so I started to learn about this bill, and then I learned about the protest and all these women who were going to this courthouse while Wendy Davis did her filibuster. And I feel it was important to know about that, even though it was Texas, because it's not just Texas. It's the entire country. And Twitter is what made that possible. And so social media is not always just frivolous. Sometimes it really does help you become more aware of the world that we live in.
Mm. At the beginning of Bad Feminist, you talk about this notion of the feminist icon that we put up on a pedestal. And, you know, when the cracks start to show, we all kind of get really angry and blame feminism. I guess part of the irony is that you've now become one of our icons, warts and all.
But you're
a different kind. You're a different kind of you know, feminist icon, I think. And I guess I'm wanting to know where to next. What's the next novel about?
Oh, funny you should ask. The icon thing, no. No. I mean, it's not that I don't want people to like me. I do. I don't mind that people think that I have valuable things to say, but what scares me is how quickly we're willing to tear someone down when they make a mistake. And I make a lot of mistakes, and so if you don't put me on the pedestal, you won't have to be upset about having to yell at me for something I've done wrong. But what am I working on now? My next novel is called Nice Man, and it's about a woman who, when she's, I haven't decided yet, but right now she's 13, she comes home and finds her parents dead, and her father has murdered her mother and then killed himself. She enters the foster care system and then goes to college at 16. And while she's in college, she meets a venture capitalist. She's a computer programmer. She meets a venture capitalist who she marries because he promises to just, you know, change her life. And she's seen so much suffering that she thinks this is a way out. Through a strange series of events, he convinces her to have a child via surrogacy for his sister. And she's also the egg donor. And so the novel looks at her relationship with her biological daughter, who is technically her niece, and how she tries to get her daughter back. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Publication date.
Still writing it, but I was like, after I read Gone Girl, I was like, I'm gonna write me a Gone Girl. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Oh, great. Hi. I love you. Hi. So, you know, I've been familiar with your work for some time, and I was surprised when I saw your name pop up on the Vulture recaps of Outlander. And I thought, what's Roxanne going to say about Outlander? And it was great, and praise Beyonce and everything. But I'm interested in what you think about the concept of Outlander, and it's talked a lot in the media as being, sorry if everyone doesn't know, Outlander is about a lady who goes back in time in Scotland and has lots of sex, it's great. About the concept of, that's talked a lot in the media about Outlander being a really feminist kind of show, or a show for women, or the new sex for women, when the main character is actually very vulnerable and put back in time in a place where she's definitely at the mercy of lots of men, but seems to have a lot of autonomy. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that as a feminist kind of text?
I think that we're so desperate for feminist texts that we're like, yeah, this is feminist. The bar is about this high. I love the show. I think it's fun and, Jamie. Yeah. Look. I will go to 16 whatever the fuck, and Jamie whatever, except the bathing problem, but, you know, ugh, he's so fine, he's so fine, his arms and his, just, but it's not, I mean, I think there are some feminist moments in that Claire is a nurse, and she has opinions, and she's intelligent, and so on, but you'll notice that she's almost sexually assaulted at least twice in the first season. And, right? I mean, and that's to remind us that she's a woman and that this is what it's like to be a woman. Now, that's kind of true, but it's not, I mean, you can't, again, it goes back to this idea of a woman's vulnerability as a narrative thrust. And Jamie always comes to the rescue. And so how feminist is that, really? Frankly, she should be coming to Jamie's rescue. He doesn't seem... He's... What?
He's like 12 in Scotland.
Exactly. And he's also very clumsy. And I feel like Claire is the one who's kind of the leader in that relationship. And he's just the pretty boy. And there's no shame in that.
You're welcome.
We
might go
over
this side now.
First of all, I just want to say we're so, so lucky to have you in Australia, so thank you so much for coming. Yes, woo!
It's great to be here.
And I noticed while you're here, you're on at least two public panels with Jermaine Greer, and you said recently on Twitter that you weren't at all familiar with her work, but that she was obviously a hateful bigot.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, now you've got more than 140 characters to explain that, if you could expand a bit more.
Yes, so, you know, one of the things I talk about in Bad Feminist is that I'm not super well-read. I mean, I am, but I didn't know who Jermaine Greer was. I had confused her with Graham Greene. And so... I'm not proud of this. I'm not proud of my ignorance. But when I get invited to stuff, I honestly don't look at my schedule until the day of, because I'm on the road every week. I'm never home. And so I don't have time to like sit and linger and like think about things. And so I didn't really know. I had read the schedule, but I didn't really process it. And so then someone on Twitter, and this goes up to the pedestal thing, was like, what are you doing on a panel with Jermaine Greer? And I was like, I don't know who the fuck Jermaine Greer is. And then I realized, I went to Google, of course, immediately, and consulted Dr. Google, and then I was like, oh, Christ. I think that she has contributed a lot to feminist thought, and certainly you can respect that, but I find that her stance on transgender women is unconscionable. And you can't be a feminist and decide that you're only going to be a feminist for some women. And so... I find her stance on transgender women just not acceptable. And I just can't. I mean, I'm not going to not appear on the panel with her. I don't think that solves anything. I don't think that's not going to make Jermaine Greer go, oh, you're right. but, you know, hopefully we can have a conversation about it during the panel. Because today is when I figured out there are two. I'm on top of it. Actually, my amazing publicist, Christine, is on top of it. So that's why I'm here on time and everything.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to know what you thought about the I don't need a feminism movement and yeah. What you would say to someone who said that to you.
I think they're delusional. whatever. I mean, I still fight for them. I think they're crazy. And I think that they're scared. No, I don't think they're crazy, because that's insulting to mental illness. I think that they are just delusional, and they are afraid. And I've been in that place where you're afraid of being seen as unaccepting of the mainstream and of men. And you don't want that, and you don't want to be on the outside looking in, ever. That's uncomfortable. And so I get that, and I pity them for that. But I also think oftentimes when you read their little signs, with misspelled words. oftentimes what they're saying is very feminist. But I think free will means that sometimes people use it badly.
Hello, thank you very much. I would like to learn a little bit more about patriarchy. We talk a lot about bad feminism, and we talk a lot about blaming feminism, but we seem to be shying more and more away from the idea of patriarchy and that we're living in one, and I wondered if you have any thoughts on that.
Oh, I think that's a constant, in the same way we don't talk about oxygen. we breathe it every day, but we're not like, oh, this oxygen is great. I think the patriarchy is constant, and I think we see it in ways both great and small. I think we see it in small ways in popular culture, and I think we see it in greater ways in terms of government and legislation, and that we're still fighting for such basic human rights. And I think that there is also a fear that if we focus too much on the word patriarchy, that people will... again, assume that you're man-hating. And I think it comes back to fear. And so I think there are a couple different things going on. But for me, personally, I just assume, like, patriarchy is constant. It's always there. And when it's no longer there, you'll see me dancing down the street. And you'll be like, what's going on with her? Oh, my God, the patriarchy must have died.
Hi. I had a bunch of questions, but of course I can only remember the really daggy one. I have followed you on Twitter, I think, since I was breastfeeding 2 years ago. I would get up in the middle of the night at 3 a.m. Nice. And feed for 45 minutes, and thank God for iPhones, because I could just sit and scroll through, you know, my Twitter feed and find out what was going on with other women in the States, women around the world. It was wonderful. And yesterday, you were talking about having many thoughts about Australia, and I said, maybe we can get some people in the audience to ask you about your thoughts about Australia. And you said, lol. So...
uh.
love to expand upon that interaction.
Australia's interesting. Oh, you know, Australia. I have to be here for 5 more days. Or no, actually 7 more days. Don't try to get me lynched. Really? I think it's an interesting place and I'm enjoying it so far and people are pretty nice. But I also think that there are some, like, okay, so I was on Twitter a couple days before I left, and it was late at night, and I was just like, oh, it's so far away, how do you get there? Are there black people in Australia? What I was meaning with that was, is there a place where I can get my hair done? And so I was looking for people in the diaspora. I do know about Aboriginal / Indigenous people very well, in fact. But it's Twitter being Twitter. A bunch of people grabbed onto that and went crazy. And I understand and I apologize because I didn't mean to disrespect anyone. But since I've come to Australia, I saw black people for the first time today. So I think that it's interesting to see that some of the issues in terms with diversity are the same throughout the world. And when I watch the commercials, they're all very... I like how everyone's like... There's a certain... They're all very heteronormative, and the men are all strapping and butch with the muscled forearms and the short haircuts. Like the Uncle Toby guy. You can pass my number to him. But, like, it's just really interesting to see. And I thought that commercials in the United States could stand to be more diverse, but it's like the promised land. There's no diversity. You don't see people of color in your commercials at all, and of any color. It's shocking. Oh, except for the one about the blind surfer. That's a great commercial. Because he's also really hot. But so it's interesting to see that it seems like maybe there's a bit of delusion about race here, where people think that things are okay, but in my experience for 4 days so far, things are perhaps not as okay as you want to believe. But it's nice. I'm having a great time.
Hi. I just want to say thank you for existing and for writing Bad Feminist and stabilizing my mental state over the last 12 months, so thank you for that. I'm a high school teacher. I teach year 8s at the moment, and I did a class the other day on diversity because I was hearing a lot of ignorant language coming out of their mouths. And this is kind of leading on to the past two questions about the patriarchy and our lack of visible diversity in media and so on. I just wanted to ask, if you were to speak to a young audience, particularly a young male audience, how would you frame the importance of equality and feminism in their generation? Because they're very defensive about the but I, and they seem to get very confused about it.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the first thing is that you can't approach them from an aggressive place. You can't make them feel like they should apologize for their existence in the same way we shouldn't have to apologize for ours. And so I think it comes down to empathy, which I think is so important. It's how do you show them that people who are different from them are affected in ways that they would never understand. By these systems, these institutions, by the patriarchy, by this lack of diversity. But I think it has to come from a place of commonality first. And it has to come from a gentler place, especially with young boys. With grown-ass men, just be like, get over yourself. But with young boys, I do think that the gentle but honest and pointed approach will work. But you can't make them feel bad just for existing and just for being, I don't know if I feel lucky being born, but lucky to have won the white male lottery, if you will. But you also have to, they have to understand what it's like to not have a male, white male body, and what it's like to move through the world where you don't get to hide anything about yourself, where you are always seen as different, and where everything is in many ways sort of conspiring against you, even though things are better. And it's hard, and I don't think it's the kind of conversation that can happen over one day. I think it's the kind of thing that has to happen over the course of the entire academic year in terms of conversations, in terms of bringing in speakers, in terms of the reading material and the visual material you put in front of them. It has to be this constant, nonstop barrage, but in a pleasant way.
I'm not going to thank you again for coming because everyone obviously has done that and we're very grateful. I want to know, I've been following your Twitter and noticed you've become aware of the Real Housewives of Melbourne and Petit Fleur. Obviously she's claiming that she's reclaiming the word bitch, and I want to know your thoughts on reclaiming the words like bitch and slut and how you feel about that as a bad feminist or a good feminist.
Yeah. Well, first of all, Petite Fleur is not reclaiming a goddamn thing. Okay, she wants to put a mirror in the floor of her Bentley so she can look at her vagina while she drives. And she's writing a book called Switch the Bitch. That's not reclaiming anything. And so she can call it whatever she wants, but that's just not what it is. I think that if I don't get to decide what other people reclaim, I'm not gonna reclaim bitch, and I'm only gonna reclaim slut in bed. I just, you know, it's for me, these are not words that I find empowering, but I absolutely respect that others do, and I think that's fine, and I support it. I'm a Libra. The worst.
Hi, Roxanne. I'm a huge fan of your work. I think you're amazing, but
Thank
everyone
you.
Else does too, so nothing's new. I just wanted to... This is a massive question, but in Australia and across the world, there's massive problems with violence. In Australia at the moment, there's more... Just about 2 women a week are killed as a result of domestic violence by a current or former partner. And I just wanted to know if you have any ideas or suggestions as to ways we could reduce the impact of domestic violence in Australia and across the world.
Absolutely. The key thing is that we have to have social programs that make it possible for women to leave abusive relationships early. Right now, we don't have any such systems here in Australia, in the United States. Quite frankly, I don't think it exists anywhere. So there are very few options, and oftentimes you have children, and so you're telling a woman with children to go to a shelter that's probably unsafe and inadequate. You're asking people to make a drastic change in lifestyle, and you can say, oh, it's your life or your Mercedes, but it's not that simple. It really isn't that simple to say, give up everything. How many people would really do it? Not as many as you'd think. And so we have to stop thinking it's as simple as just leave, because it's never just leave. If it was just leave, women wouldn't be in abusive relationships, nor would men. But I think we have to develop robust social programs for women to leave and to be safe when they leave and to have law enforcement protect them when they leave and not just say, oh, all I can do is a restraining order. A restraining order is the biggest piece of bullshit I've ever heard in my life. Like, oh, stay 500 feet away. They're barely enforceable. And so we need far more rigorous laws to protect people who leave abusive relationships. And then there have to be actual, penal consequences. Like, we have to put abusers in jail, period. So they can't get out. I mean, how is a former partner able to go and kill someone he's abused? Like, how is he out and about and enjoying the world in the same way we are? That doesn't make sense. And so I think it's just a multi-pronged approach. And it's like so pie in the sky, right? Like when you think about it, like, oh, wow, that we would respect women enough to protect them? We'll never get there as a society. And that's heartbreaking to like to sometimes think, but I still believe we have to do that. And I also think that we need to come up with counseling services that offer more than just telling women to leave, because that's just dismissive and it doesn't entirely account for the complexities of abuse.
Hi.
Sorry, I don't know if this is not on, but I do have another question. And it's for Maxine as well. And we're talking tonight about some of the deeply entrenched racial divides in this country. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about the welcome to country, as it's customary to, in some circles, talk about the fact that we're standing on the ground of, I believe it's the Kulin Nation of the Wurundjeri people. And this has been a really divisive issue in Melbourne, particularly in the last couple of years. Our Lord Mayor decided that it wasn't necessary to open council meetings with such an acknowledgement of country. There's a lot of sentiment amongst some circles that it's tokenism and not a general act of good faith. And so I was wondering, in terms of this talking about how to resolve some of those incredibly traumatic post-colonial divides, how to move beyond lip service.
I think acknowledgement to country is important, and it's my error that I didn't do it today. We are standing on the lands of the members of the Kulin Nation. I know that when, I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago that was abolished under the last Liberal government. I think there is a problem of tokenism. We do feel often that if we acknowledge country, that's enough, and I don't think it is enough. You go to Liberal Party events as well where there's no acknowledgement of country, or there is an acknowledgement of country, but, you know, there's no accompanying support of Indigenous rights or of things like narrowing the gap between Indigenous Australians and non-Indigenous Australians. I think words are important, but actions are a lot more important. And if the two don't match, then, you know, really, I don't think lip service does enough.
I would agree with all of that, and I don't know how realistic it is, but I honestly think that reparations is a step in the right direction. I don't think reparations in this country or any country is going to fix what has been done, but I also as a realist, we're not going to raise entire cities and give the land back, are we? I mean, I think we should, but it's not going to happen. So the next best thing is to compensate those who have had their land and their birthright stolen from them. And I think nearly every country in the world owes somebody some reparations. Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote an amazing article for the Atlantic last year, and he actually won an award for it recently. And I think it's called The Cost of Reparations. And I recommend, it's online, and I recommend everyone read it. And it's based on the United States, but the idea of reparations is something that could be applied in France, in Australia, in Germany. I think we have to start to think about, in addition to honoring the land that we're on, and the people it has been taken from, we have to compensate them. And there is no price that you can put on what has been taken. However, it helps. Money helps a lot. And more than that, also social programs that will prevent marginalized people from being marginalized in the next generation. Because it's not just what you can do for the people that are here now, it's what can we do for their children and their children's children so that they don't have to face what their parents faced.
I think sometimes we feel like the problem is too big, you know, and it is a great problem, but I was reminded of that. There's a section in Bad Feminist where you talk about that lack of diversity in journals, various literary publications and in terms of women and saying, look, the simplest thing to do is to find women mm-hmm. and publish women. And if you don't know women, go out and find them. You know, and I guess I think the same in terms of, you know, land rights, in terms of asylum seeker issues. The problem is so big and yet it's not.
You know, it isn't. And it is huge and overwhelming. But yeah. There are so many, like, just sitting here, I've come up with three ideas. Like, okay, return the land rights so that all the leasing fees for all of these buildings go to the people who originally own this land. I mean, I know that somebody's going to be like, hell no. But there are so many, like, let's try something, because doing nothing has not solved anything. But these are huge and overwhelming problems, and every time I sit down to think about them, I get scared by, like, how can we fix what has been broken?
At work, I recently overheard two men talking about how, oh, we're in the girls' team now because there were more females than men in the team.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
So I called them on it and said, oh, well, what's wrong with being in the girls' team? And their response was, oh, no, well, no, nothing. And now they don't like me. How active a feminist do you have to be to not be a bad feminist without isolating yourself?
You know, it doesn't matter. You could be like a 15th of a feminist, and that would be too much. First of all, congratulations. You know, I think it's important to speak up. You didn't even do anything that big a deal. You didn't really throw feminism in their face. You just said, what's the big deal about being on the girls' team? Because obviously the boys' team couldn't hang. You know, I don't think there's anything you can do. It's not about you, and it's not about your feminism. Whether you display feminism or not, they're going to say those shitty things. And so it's a question of how much are you willing to tolerate? And I think you found your line.
I wasn't actually going to ask this question because I didn't want to turn it into a race issue, but since you brought it up about your observations since you've been here about the lack of diversity in Australia, I'd be curious to know from my own personal experience, because I happen to be a black journalist in Australia, believe it or not, and I'm the only one visibly on television, and it's something that I am struggling with because I'm a minority that is trying to be visible. And at times it is very challenging because you don't want to be that person that is a spokesperson for people of colour or is coming out, but at the same time you can't not say anything. And I'd be curious to know, how would you navigate that if you were living in Australia and a black woman?
Yeah, you know, I navigate that even in my current life. I live in the Midwest in the United States. I was born in Nebraska, where there are no black people, except for me now, and my parents, and like four other people. It's really, really hard. It's very lonely. It's very isolating. Even when you don't want to be the representative for your people, you are forced into that role. When you push back against that, they think, what are you, ashamed? What? I think that I don't have an answer for you. That's a great question. And it's hard. But I think you have to continue to be visible. And I think sometimes we have to put ourselves in these challenging positions so that the young men and women who are at home watching TV and seeing you do your job know what's possible for them. And so one of the things that can help you get through it is knowing that someone is seeing you on the television screen and is feeling like something more is possible for them than what they previously thought. And that's not enough, but it's something. And also demanding to your superiors that they just hire someone else. Like, Noah had two of everything on the ark. And I truly believe that, you know, but the funny thing is that people expect that if they hire two black people or two Asians or two people of any group that you're going to get along. Like, I don't like the other black woman in my department. I'm kidding. You know, it's just because you share the same skin tone or the same, or even if you're just people of color, which sometimes that's enough. For me, that's enough these days. I'm just like, whatever, anyone, bring it. It doesn't mean you're going to get along, that you're going to agree, and nor should you. But at least it would be, I find that it's nice to walk down the hall sometimes and just see someone with a little melanin. Just a little, or a lot. It's hard, and that's a shitty answer, but it's hard.
Hi, Roxanne.
Hi.
First of all, I'm a huge fan of yours. Your book's perfect.
It's not perfect.
sorry. It's like the whole point of it. But I run a feminist club at school, which is fun. But unfortunately, it tends to focus on the issues of middle class, heterosexual, cisgender, white women. Mm-hmm. So I was, which, you know, it's really annoying, but I was wondering if you had any ideas for how to make it a more inclusive and safe space for all women, all students, without it being like a tokenistic thing.
Are you in high school or college?
I'm in high school.
Oh. Oh, I just want to hug you. And I hate hugs. Bless your heart. That you know the word cisgender in high school? That's awesome.
I'm on Tumblr.
Oh, man. I think that you have to, you know, the one thing you can't really do is sort of bring people in and say, talk to us about your life, and then, like, you know, be our educator and then go away. You have to make these issues your issues, even though they may not be your issues, because they are your issues. If you're a feminist, issues that affect all women affect you. And so it's approaching it like that, by saying, okay, even if we don't have a transgender woman in our club, we need to make sure that we're thinking about what transgender women are dealing with, especially at the high school level. That's rough. High school is rough anyway. And when you are differently gendered and you show gender in different ways in high school, unless you go to a really great school, you are a target. And so what kinds of things can you do as a club to make the school a safer space? What kinds of policies can you suggest to the principal to make the school a safer space? What can you do to encourage students of color to join the club and not feel like they're coming as representatives of their ethnicity or race? And how can you make them feel like they are as valued as anyone else? So these are the kinds of questions that you want to start to grapple with. But you're just already headed in the right direction just by being in high school and having a feminist club. It's so great.
Thank you. I hope everyone's had a fantastic time. There are, I think there's three or four more in this F-word series, so have a look on the Wheeler Centre website and see what you think. So everybody, please give a huge hand to Roxanne.